For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. Gentlemen, labels, labels, labels. Everything has a label these days.
You just labeled me a gentleman, and I take issue with that.
Well, you know.
I'm more of a caveman.
I was kind of looking around for the gentleman he was addressing.
Right. But,
Now, see, right there. We've got labels on everything. And, you know, from a political standpoint, from a social standpoint, liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat, independent,
libertarian.
We've got labels on everything. Recently, there's a book that's come out from Professor Patrick Deneen called Why Liberalism Failed. And we're going to have him on the show here in a few minutes. But guys, what's liberalism? What's conservatism? What are we looking at here?
Yeah, because, you know, when Professor Deneen uses the term why liberalism failed, he's not talking about it in terms of a left-right divide. He's actually talking about it in terms of both and. And that's kind of a big part of the book is kind of how liberalism is an all-encompassing ideology. He uses the word ideology that encompasses both the left and the right side of the political spectrum to continue to push its agenda along.
Yeah, he's a very astute and insightful political theorist who teaches up at the University of Notre Dame. He's been a Catholic Cave before. It's great. So grateful that he's going to be able to join us here after a quick break we have coming up, because we're going to want to unpack this. This is going to be very interesting. I encourage you to stay tuned. This is going to be a show that involves politics, but it's not going to be political. So stay tuned to the Catholic Cave. Patrick Deneen coming right up.
And we'll be back with that interview right after this. You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy. 40 Days for Life is a campaign of peaceful prayer vigils held at the site of abortion providers throughout the world with the goal of eliminating abortion. Here in Central Indiana, the Lenten 40 Days for Life campaign will run from Ash Wednesday, February 14th, through Palm Sunday, March 25th. Would you consider making this campaign a part of your Lenten observance? Go to 40daysindy.org for more information. That's 40daysindy.org.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford, and I'd like to welcome to the Cave, very special guest, welcome back to the Cave, Professor Patrick Deneen. Professor Deneen is the Potenziani Memorial Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame. He is the author of several books, most importantly, the one we're talking about today, Why Liberalism Failed. So welcome to the show, Professor Deneen.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah. Now, why liberalism failed? You use liberalism in a slightly different way, I think, than most people would.
The
would
pejoratives kind of, that we usually use.
Exactly. You know, most people are accustomed to liberalism being kind of a political program on the left side of the fence. You use it, though, you're pretty explicit at the beginning. Liberalism is an ideology, according to you. So can you start off a little bit explaining to our listeners why you classify liberalism as an ideology?
Right. Well, by ideology, I mean, even that word, of course, tends to be used somewhat promiscuously. But I mean a theory of politics that begins with, a conception of human nature that doesn't conform to reality, and that reality ultimately has to conform to it. And so it begins with the idea that we are, think of the state of nature scenarios you find in something like John Locke. It begins with this premise that our nature is such that we are, by nature, free, autonomous, individual choosing, self-making selves, and that we shape and craft our own lives, that we are the sort of makers of ourselves. And we all know, sort of based on our reality, that's not true, right? I mean, we all know we're born into families and we're born into a particular time and a particular place and in a certain historical moment. So in a sense, it's not, this idea of ourselves is not true. And this is why I call it an ideology, because what's striking about the liberal political order is that over time, what it's done is make it more and more true. It's turned us increasingly into these creatures that it premises exist by nature. Of course, it does this not by nature, but by artifice, by a kind of vast architecture involving the state and the market and science and technology and education and, you know, the whole range, you could say, of institutions of human life become oriented to turning us into these creatures. And so this is why I call it an ideology, in the same way that I suggest that communism or fascism are ideologies. And they're not, basically not, I don't mean to compare them in terms of sort of brutality and evil, but the sense in which reality is forced to conform to an idea that itself is not ground and based in reality.
And just as people paid a price in socialist, you know, socialist countries or in communist countries, there's a price that we're paying to a certain extent for this liberalism that you know, I think you compare it to the air we breathe, to be perfectly honest. It's hard to identify it because it's so ubiquitous all around us. But there's a price that we pay, and that's kind of what you're laying out in your book.
Well, that's right. In fact, it's the price. As I put it, and the title of the book is meant to be, of course, provocative, Why Liberalism Failed. But what I mean by that is that liberalism, I suggest, has failed because it succeeded, because it has, in fact, to a great extent, now created that world based upon that idea or that vision of what human freedom consists of and what the ideal human life consists of. And so when we look around the world today and we think of the sort of price of the freedom of these sort of individuated selves, I mean, we could begin with a very, you know, obviously identifiable issue, which is abortion, right? One of the core features of modern liberal orders is that we free ourselves, in a sense, from our biology, from a fact of nature, that as human creatures, human sexuality is oriented toward reproduction. And so we're going to deny that part of ourselves in the name of freedom and overcome that part of ourselves. And there's a price, right? We could say the price is the murder of millions upon millions of people. And that's just in some ways the most obvious. We could say that many of the pathologies that we see in the world today, and I think today there's an opioid conference taking place or summit taking place at the White House, kind of addiction, the rampant inability of people in some ways to exercise forms of self-governance and the flourishing of the self and the increasing reliance upon pharmaceuticals or pornography or the internet or distractions, et cetera, are all ways that this liberated self ends up in many ways paying a deep and profound civilizational cost.
So that's, take us back a little bit, if you would, Professor Dineen. Where does liberalism, when does it kind of first arrive on the scene? What's sort of the genesis and maybe start there and then kind of move us forward in time a little bit?
Well, of course, you know, there are a lot of historical explanations for its rise. And the one that you'll typically hear is it was the kind of political means of settling what had become irresolvable disputes in the religious realm, theological realm, so the wars of religion in Europe, particularly following the Reformation. And that's certainly a major way in which it will be described. And this is often the way it's described, as it was necessary as a way for people who have plural beliefs or diverse beliefs in the nature of the good to resolve those problems that had been irresolvable and increasingly dealt with by means of violence. It's been argued by some, and I think one of the more interesting arguments is by William T. Kavanaugh, who's written a book called The Myth of Religious Violence, that this argument has tended to be used as a kind of veil over actually what in some ways was a kind of effort to assert a certain kind of change of regime by the displacement, in particular, of one set of people with another set of people. In the book, what I tend to focus on in particular was that the particular form in which this idea of liberty takes place is in significant part a response to what we could say was a way of organizing society along aristocratic hereditary lines, right? So if we think of aristocratic or hereditary societies, who you are and your identity is defined by who you come from. So if you're born to a peasant class, you will remain a peasant. If you're born to an aristocrat, you will remain an aristocrat. Titles are passed from one generation to the next. And even if you think of kind of the old Anglo-Saxon names, Smith and Weaver and Taylor and Cooper, these weren't just names, these were professions. So your
right.
name was literally right. what you would be doing. And in this sense, you could say we can have a something of a sympathy for liberalism to the extent that I think even any modern American would say, yeah, I don't want to be defined simply by what I'm born into.
Yeah, trapped. But, trapped.
Right. Yeah, trapped, we all, trapped I mean, by, you know, I, although, I'm... I have to admit, I'm probably happier being a college professor than a potato farmer
right.
in Ireland.
Although I remind Mark often that O'Donnell means I do come from Irish kings. He refuses to acknowledge that, though, Professor. But that's
right.
an aside.
But even but right, but think about that name, right?
Right.
O'Donnell means of Donald, or Mick Donald. You're of Donald, or Johnson. You're the son of John. So. All of these old names, right, are indications that we are who we are because we come from something else, or that we were born in a place.
A family, a clan, a tradition.
Right. So liberalism is, in some ways, you could say, is the effort to say, no, we're not defined by who we come from, but you could say it takes it in this kind of extreme direction, which is to say we're entirely self-fashioning creatures, and that we make ourselves. And this is the idea of the state of nature, right, that we conceive of ourselves by nature as completely unrelated to other human beings, as these kind of Thomas Hobbes describes at one point as mushrooms that pop up kind of from nowhere,
right?
Without parents, without lineage, and I think as a result, kind of built deeply into the operating system of the liberal order, what we have seen is increasingly this has becomes the not just the description of sort of how we begin, it actually is increasingly the description of what we become. If we think of a civilization increasingly which people are no longer marrying, or if they do get married, in which they move in and out of marriages fairly quickly, in many cases, in which they're no longer having children because that's a burden on our liberty, in which they're no longer, in a sense, retaining or even embracing a religious tradition, or any religious tradition, the rise, what they say in the millennial generation is the nuns, people who don't believe or affiliate with a religion. Even in younger generations, declining levels of patriotism, and even commitment to democracy itself, one sees. So the creature imagined as existing in the state of nature now is increasingly the creature that we've created.
And in order to create that creature, we have to sort of liberate ourselves from nature. That's kind of a big part of the liberal project is, I guess, freeing ourselves from all confines, whether they're social confines, all constraints.
Yeah.
And that's a different conception of freedom that existed up until the Enlightenment.
Yeah, well, in fact, you could say it's almost the opposite. So the same word is used. But meaning completely opposite things. So when you come across the word freedom or liberty in ancient Greek and thinkers like Plato or Aristotle, in the Roman tradition like Cicero, and obviously in the Christian tradition, St. Paul or Augustine or Aquinas, what they mean by liberty is the orientation toward the good, and that one is free when one chooses the good, that there's a that one is oriented, and indeed that there's a kind of yearning for the good, that's what we're oriented toward, and that one is finally free when one chooses, you know, makes the final step in that yearning to choose the good. And that's the condition of freedom. But that what modern liberty comes to be defined as is the freedom, in a sense, to do or to choose whatever one wants, and the absence of obstacles to the choice of freedom. You know, if I ask a class of students, and I teach at Notre Dame, it's a Catholic university, but if I ask a class of students what's freedom, they will, to a person, define it in terms of the modern definition of liberty. It's so pervasive that even people raised in the Catholic, right, probably mostly going to Catholic schools, have never been introduced to this more classic or Christian understanding of liberty.
Well, it seems like it's also kind of a, again, radical living out of, well, you can be, you know, you can grow up to be anything you want to be. And that used to be, when I was, that was signaling to a young person, you have a lot of potential. There's a variety of things, of options that you have, that you could, you know, vocations you might pursue, talents and gifts that you could discover and develop and put at the service of others. But it's gone way too far, right? Because now it's gone into, we just had another guest on, Dr. Ryan T. Anderson, talking about, you know, transgender ideology. I mean, that to me seems like, again, another feature, and it comes up, you know, another feature of liberalism is this, I'm so free as to even remake my gender or my sexuality in really any form that I can might conceive of.
Well, you can see how this is really just the kind of extension, the logical extension of precisely this idea of liberty, which is that I feel confined by my biology. I feel confined by some kind of givenness of my nature that I have to fundamentally alter that. So the transgender move today in our society is really, it's not a departure from this basic trajectory. It's a further, you know, a further advance. And I don't even want to say it's a culmination, because I think we're just in some ways at the beginning, in particular, of cracking into, as it were, human nature, of the project of seeking to alter human nature. But, you know, just to touch briefly on that, what I think is really interesting, that, you know, the idea that, and I was certainly told, you know, you can grow up to be anything you want to be. You know, I'm 5 foot, if I'm generous, I could say I'm 5'6". And if I say I want to be, you know, a professional basketball player, I can believe all I want that I can grow up to be anything I want to be. But that's actually probably not going to happen.
There are certain
limitations. I think, again, if you think about what the classical tradition would tell us, it wouldn't be that you can grow up to be anything you want to be. And maybe it, you know, we can understand we shouldn't be nostalgic for a world in which you're basically told what to be. But on the other hand, I think there's a kind of middle position, which is to say, and we think about it in the language of vocation, that part of finding out what you're going to be is a discernment of what are my gifts? You know, what are the gifts that were given to me that were, you know, particularly endowed to me, and that are gifts that have been given to me that I in turn can give to the world. And that's a kind of process of discernment that doesn't begin with the idea I can be anything I want to be. It's a discernment of what am I, and what are those gifts, and what is my vocation. And that, again, that language of vocation, the idea of calling, is a calling that takes place outside of yourself. And so it's not generated from my own will and my own desires, and this, again, this idea of self-fashioning, but that there's a givenness to the created world that we partake in. And we don't simply make, but we partake in, and we do go through a kind of process of discernment, and that's somehow it seems to me a more appealing, and it seems to me a truer way of discussing the kinds of way of thinking about the person we're going to be, than either saying, you know, you are what you are because that's what you were born into, or that you can be whatever you want to be.
We're talking with Professor Patrick Deneen, author of Why Liberalism Failed. Professor Deneen, I've got a question about your ability to be an NBA basketball player. Because there's part of me that just says you've been born a few centuries or a few decades too early. Give it some time and technology will catch up. You know, the technology is coming down the road that's going to be able to give you the ability to have an enhanced body to where if you really wanted to become an NBA player, you'd be able to, you know, somehow stretch your DNA so that you'd be able to be a 6'4", you know, basketball player, you know, if that's really truly what you want to do. And I kind of throw that out there just as a sort of question of has technology kind of accelerated this whole process of liberalism, of being able to redefine who we are?
Yeah, so I actually have a chapter on technology in the book, and I'm actually glad you asked me about technology, because so far in many discussions and podcasts, very few people have asked me anything about that chapter, but I think it's an extremely important chapter.
It's my favorite one. It's number four.
Yeah, it's number four in terms of its number, not in terms of your favorite.
Correct. Exactly. It's called Technology and the Loss of Liberty. So I'm glad we're going to get into this. So go right ahead, Professor.
Well, so the first thing I want to point out is that we've always been technological creatures, right? Human beings, in some ways, by definition, are the creatures. We could call ourselves Homo techne, in addition to calling ourselves Homo sapiens. And techne is the Greek word, which means the something that's made or something that's created. And you could say human beings, unlike almost every other creature, are the creatures that exist and that survive in the world because of our ability to be technological creatures. And so we've really narrowed our understanding of what technology is, you know, increasingly just basically the thing that you have in your pocket that you, you know, check out stock quotes on or something. But that technology has always been really the, you could say, one of the defining features of human beings. But to my mind, it's not so much that we're creatures who use technology, it's in some ways the underlying assumptions, and now think again about this idea of liberty, the underlying assumptions that we have as a civilization that itself orients how we think of and how we develop and how we deploy technology. So if we go back to that kind of classical understanding of liberty, that there's a kind of givenness to the world, it's a created order, that we have a nature, it's a given nature, then the technology that we develop is, in some ways you could say, exists alongside of and respects the existence of nature. And so you could say one of the ways that technology, or one form of technology, I would say, is actually kind of what I would call culture. That culture is a way that we develop ourselves in a kind of a made world with traditions and customs that respect, among other things, the nature of human beings. So, for example, we're creatures that come of age, right? We have a difficult time in that period of puberty and teenagehood. And so cultures have always acknowledged this and developed, you know, kind of ways of helping young people into adulthood and ways of navigating this difficult time. And we're creatures that are oriented toward reproduction and sexuality, but this is a dangerous thing. It's perilous. And so we've developed institutions, certainly marriage and forms and ceremonies over marriage and a kind of communal recognition of marriage as a kind of good of society, sacramental form of celebration as well, that, again, you could say works with nature and is constituted in many ways by nature. So this is, I would say this is one form of technology that we tend not to think of as technology. What we tend to think of as technology is modern technology, which in the liberal understanding, the natural order is one of the obstacles to our form of freedom. That that freedom, the ability to do what we want, means that we have to roll back any obstacles to that freedom. And one thing that has to be rolled back is the freedom from other people. So that's the state of nature scenario and the idea that we make ourselves. But the other great obstacle is, of course, nature and the natural world. And so that modern technology treats nature as a kind of inert substance, the stuff that we can manipulate in whatever way that we wish. And you could say this is true of how we treat the natural world in terms of, you know, moving from a kind of farming tradition that, you know, respects the processes of nature and seeks to accelerate them through genetic modification of crops and so forth. But increasingly, and to get back where we began this conversation, increasingly the capacity to, in some ways, change our own nature, right? To alter what we might think of as the given nature of human beings. So to make ourselves into potentially basketball players, or to make ourselves smarter, or ultimately, and I think the ultimate prize, is to overcome mortality, to make ourselves immortal. There's a book out, recent book out, by an author named Yuval Noah Harari called Homo Deus, which is all about this, about our technological increasing ability, technological ability, to make ourselves into gods, that is to say, creatures that are immortal, and are sort of all powerful in their ability to control and manipulate the substances of the world.
And that's a fascinating book. And some of the in your book too, you make reference to that. But also, a lot of you touch on important cultural signposts such as movies, television shows, and so I want to talk about that just a little bit too, because it ties into that concept. So there's one of my favorite parts of this chapter on technology is where you make reference to a show I find very fascinating, which is the new HBO series Westworld, and you point out in your commentary, if I'm reading you right, how the androids are actually more humane than the humans in a lot of ways. And what a fascinating sort of storyline that is. But even more so maybe to me is that's the story, you know, because it's a fictional television series, that's the story we're telling ourselves.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating series. And as I continued watching it, I don't know who's what mind is behind this, but it seems to be quite brilliant that precisely it's showing how exactly what I was, as I was just saying, a humanity now that sees and treats the world as mere stuff is going to become a kind of barbaric humanity, right? And of course, we already see that, the way in which we treat unborn children, the way in which we treat Down syndrome children, unborn, certainly Down syndrome children, the way in which increasingly we want to treat the elderly who are no longer useful to us, that viewing human beings as stuff means that we are going to treat ourselves as stuff. And I think this also, you could say this is relevant to a pornographic culture, too, a culture that treats our sexuality essentially as the interaction of our genitalia with stuff in the world, and will treat other human beings merely as means, sex slavery, et cetera, but also, think of where this is going, that Westworld portrays a world in which you can do anything you want with robots, and there's predictions that people will basically start to use robots for their own satisfaction. And so Westworld, it seems to me, is really, I think, brilliantly treating the dehumanization of human beings by suggesting that it may be that our machines start to look more human than we are.
And there's the violence that it portrays in that series is just unnerving, because the androids themselves are, for all intents and purposes, exact replicas of human beings to the senses. And so when they commit violence, they're there to a large measure. The leisure activity is comprised of, as you mentioned, one, there's this acting out on raw sexual impulses and fantasies, but even more so, it's acting out on impulses to slaughter other human beings. What that is doing to us, and what it's turned, as you mentioned, I really like what you said before about it's about who we're becoming, and this to me is a very dark portent of a shadowy direction that humanity is turning in through the employing this technology.
Well, I think it's an attempt to show what happens when we liberate ourselves from our own humanity. Yeah, that what it's portraying there is the ultimate liberation, where we've been so liberated that we're no longer human.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And you can say, again, think about this book called Homo Deus. The whole object is to no longer be human, right? is to turn us into. In fact, Harari proposes that we're going to create another species. And what's remarkable about this proposal is the incredible kind of baseless optimism that we're going to make ourselves somehow better through this kind of technological expansion or elongation of life. So what is it? There's no reflection in that book, for example. What does it do to the relationship between parents and children when parents don't leave the scene, or when an older generation doesn't leave the scene? You could say we prepare children for adulthood because we know that someday they're going to have to assume the station of life that we're in right now, and we want them to do so in a way that we think is responsible and will continue a chain of responsibility. And what happens when, if we indeed prolonged our life to such a point where we were sharing, decades upon decades upon decades of our lifespan with our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, would there be a place for them? And would we raise them for lives of responsibility? That's just one reflection. It doesn't even begin to scratch the surface, it seems to me, of things that the kind of techno-optimistic worldview assumes. And so just to round this out, that we live in a world now today that is really techno-optimistic. And again, I see this in my students who've grown up sort of thinking that everything available at their fingertips means everything's always better. And there are very few, you could say there are very few voices or perspectives today that are providing some kind of warning about this. And this is where I see a really fascinating interaction taking place between the long Catholic tradition that has been very adamant against, it seems to me, the kind of the effort to overcome, put it in theological terms, Gnosticism, right?
Right,
The sort of the hatred of the created material order is a Gnostic impulse. So on the one hand, the Catholic understanding, theological understanding, and kind of this dystopian science fiction vision. And so there's ways in which the dystopic tradition and the Catholic vision can, you know, in interesting ways combine and assist each other, or at least offer potentially a kind of cautionary note into otherwise overly optimistic times.
I'm glad you bring that up, the idea of some sort of remedy, because that's one of the commentaries about the book that I think I've heard the most is, the problem is laid out there. And brilliantly, I might add.
Yeah, it's a brilliant book.
And you point out very clearly, and I think correctly, too, that there's not really a political remedy to this particular problem, mainly because, you know, the way politics is divided between left and right, both of them are continuing to contribute to
the problem,
the furthering of liberalism. So, you know, trying to find a political problem in itself is just going to make things worse. What kind of remedies, though, do you have in mind? I mean, you touch on them very briefly at the end, but when you're looking at remedies for how to kind of push back against this expansion of liberalism, what kind of things do you have in mind?
Well, so yeah, the first instance, I do it. And I write as a political thinker. I'm a political theorist by training. And so I do analyze the problem in to a significant extent, though not exclusively, through a political lens. We've just been talking about technology, that ultimately this is going to affect all aspects of life. But what I do try to, I hope, show is that at the base of any political crisis is an anthropological crisis, by which I mean not the discipline of anthropology, but the assumption of human nature, the assumption about anthropos, of human nature. And if you get your understanding of human nature wrong, your politics are going to be quite bad. So the solution, I guess, and I keep getting pressed, as you're right, that especially from people working in journalism and public policy who kind of want to know, what do we do to fix this? And if we can just get the right patch, this will all be better. And really, I hope the thrust of the argument in my book is that this is not a solution that's going to come from within the liberal order. It starts with a bad set of anthropological assumptions, and so we have to begin by changing the anthropological assumptions. And you can't just do that by flipping a light switch.
Right.
As I said, you ask even kids who've grown up in Catholic schools what liberty is, and if they repeat to you, the modern definition of liberty, you know how deeply instilled this is. So at the end of the book, as a way of offering what I think is the beginning of what I think is much more long-term and even potentially, several generational project, is to suggest that we eschew thinking of the problem in merely or exclusively political terms, and that we begin, in the first instance, to cultivate a kind of culture. And by that I mean thinking of ourselves as relational creatures, not as these isolated individuals, interacting with each other and with the natural world as one through attitudes of gratitude and obligation, not merely the assertion of liberty and rights. And that this is something you can do right away, and it doesn't require you to win an election or to get a Supreme Court appointment. This is something that can be done in our own backyards, in our churches, obviously in our families, in our schools, or maybe the need to create new schools. But that this is the it's a problem today of practice and not necessarily of theory. But that said, I do think that the longer term project is going to require a really different way of conceiving ourselves and our politics, and that's where it gets harder, because I don't have a crystal ball and I can't say in advance how people will develop out of the kinds of ideas that will develop out of these practices. But I can, I have some pretty good ideas. I mean, I do think that, just to use an old Catholic term, I mean, I think a political order that's premised much more on the ideals of subsidiarity and solidarity are going to be essential. And by, in particular, subsidiarity, we live in a world that's increasingly centralized, both economically and politically, and in which the centers of power are distant and ungoverned by us. And one of the deep frustrations of contemporary peoples, it seems to me, is this feeling of powerlessness. And this is a paradox I talk about a number of times in the book, that it's a people who have been led to believe that they're completely free, and in this condition of this radically liberated self, that end up feeling powerless because the tools of our liberation end up in some ways putting us into a condition of bondage. And so to counter that set of arrangements, a sort of deep form of reorganization is necessary. And I'm not saying this is a revolution we need to do next week. It's going to be slow, and I hope it will be slow, because it would be a little bit jarring otherwise. The beginnings of a society organized much more on the order of subsidiarity, by which is meant, if something can be solved, if there's an issue that can be solved at the most local level, that's where it should be solved, because that's where people are going to be most empowered, most invested, most committed, most knowledgeable. But if there are issues that can't be resolved at a local level, then you need to go not automatically to the federal government or to a world government, but to the next highest sort of level of public life, and so on and so forth. And if you think about our politics today, where does our politics begin and end? It's all discussions of the federal government and what the federal government's going to do. And it shows you already how deeply, sort of skewed and almost pathological we've arranged our political lives today.
On the flip side, I do think there's some hope and some signs. Maybe they're just kind of wisps of smoke at this point. But the homeschooling movement I think is moving to remedy a lot of the issues that you bring up in the context of your chapter on education. I think there's a move towards local agriculture and localized agriculture, farmers markets, things like that. That you get this sort of feeling that people are beginning to recognize that, hey, these are problems that can and should and ought to be addressed at the local level. And there's at least the beginnings of an attempt to kind of reorganize, I think, along those lines.
You couldn't be more wrong, Mark.
I don't want to get between the two of you. But, I will say this, that if I'm right that liberalism is an ideology, and I've had debates with people about this. There are people who say, no, it's not. It's the anti-ideology. It allows for lots of different ways of life. But I think I'm right that it's an ideology. And by that, to go back where we began, it's an effort to shape reality according to a false conception or a false idea. And we can say that all ideologies will ultimately fail, right, because they don't conform to reality, right? They can deform things for a long time. And we certainly saw under communism a profound deformation of human society, and indeed a violent and horrific deformation of society. The murder of millions of people under Stalin. Now, of course, we're living in a different kind of ideological realm in which we also murder people. We just don't recognize them as human. But that ultimately reality will out, I would suggest. And what I guess the more hopeful signs, it seemed to me, if we give them some credit, would suggest that reality is always going to be, in a sense, reasserting itself. And so I do think there's one of the things that strikes me about the reception of my book, and I should say that the reception of my book has not simply been an interest among Catholics. I've been very happy that Catholics have been interested in it, but it really has been across the sort of religious or non-religious political spectrum. People on the left, I just did an interview the other day with The Nation, the really left-wing secular magazine. I think there's a just deep and profound, widespread sense of deep discontent with...
And anxiety, and you point to that.
Definitely, definitely anxiety with the current order, but a kind of opening that I don't think we've ever seen in the course of our lifetime. Now, this might be a reason for some hope. Of course, there's a. I think we need to be cautious and think it might also be a reason for some fear, because at times of anxiety, people can do some very bad things. And there are a lot of people who want to basically maintain the liberal order at any cost, and will do so, at, you know, I think, ultimately, even at the point of a gun. So it's a time of some possibility and even hope, but of course also peril and danger.
Well, what we have to do is make sure everyone picks up a copy of your book. We're speaking with Professor Patrick Dineen from the University of Notre Dame, up there in God's country, I call it. his book is Why Liberalism Failed. Outstanding, brilliant book. I get the appeal is far beyond just simply Catholic circles. Catholics will love this book, but it goes much broader. It's for a much broader audience than just Catholics. And I got to tell you too, I was one of the things, and one of the, again, I'm fascinated by chapter 4 on this technocracy, and here was one of the I'm gonna bring this up because I know we'll run out of time before, but one of the latest movies I watched was called The Justice League, and it's, you know, one of the latest and all the Avengers superhero things like that. But what came to mind, why I bring it up here in relation to your book, is the villain, if you will, that is Steppenwolf. It goes by Steppenwolf, and what does he do? He's bringing these three cubes. His mission is he's trying to get these three cubes put back together that will then bring about unity. And the way unity is achieved is through complete destruction. And I kind of think, in a certain weird way, this is kind of where technology may be leading us, in that it's, and on one hand, as you point out, if I read this chapter correctly, it creates a convergence, I think is the word you use, a flattening of everything. And at the same time, it's destroying everything that came before it. And that's what made me think of that, of that arc villain in the movie, and what his project is, in a certain sense. That's why I'm not optimistic at all at how this is going to turn out, actually. And the other part is, it's the technology. I think of Dr. Twenge's book on iGens. There's what we're facing now that's maybe different from past ideologies that can be overcome. Is there's a, you know, it's rewiring our brains quite literally. The social media and the way we're interacting with technology. Well, I don't know that was a feature of previous ideologies that we had to face. And I, you know, obviously have supreme confidence in God's providence, but it looks like this is a very difficult task, given how deeply it's penetrated our understanding of reality and distorted and perverted it, but also how it's rewiring our very brain.
Yeah, when I say that I have confidence in reality, I think you're pointing to a deep anxiety that I have, which is that is what I understand to be reality in the created order. Will that continue under the onslaught of this effort of technological transformation, not only, of course, of the world, but of human nature itself, and you know, literally trying to change what human beings are? You know, again, I agree with you. I think that one can certainly anticipate potential catastrophes as a consequence of this. But in a way, the catastrophe is itself the form of reality reasserting itself. Right. It doesn't mean it's going to be a happy reassertion.
Right.
I don't foresee any outcome of this experiment of self, of sort of human self-alteration ending particularly well, other than perhaps after a long road of deep self-deception, the conclusion that a defined wrong turn was taken, And you know, we're not the first generation in human history where that's happened. You know, just have to read the Bible and the stories over and over and over again that right. human beings are thick in the head.
Right.
And we, you know, stiff-necked even if God is there telling us how we should live, we are going to stray. So I think you're right to say we ought to have supreme confidence in providence, but we ought not to also be sanguine that we're not going to mess up a lot along the way.
That's absolutely right.
Well, Professor Dineen, unfortunately, we are just about out of time, but before we let you go, how about you inform our listeners a little bit about some of the projects that you're working on? Kind of what's next for you?
I know Amazon has all your books. That's what I recommend. Pick up
sure.
anything
well,
by the good professor. Yeah, we'll enjoy it.
Right now, I mean, this book, I have to say, it's really hit a chord in ways that I didn't expect, and I think Yale University Press, which published it, didn't expect. They sold out before the first week was out. That was exciting, but frustrating because books weren't available. They had printed out a lot of new copies. So in the next couple of months, I'll probably be doing a lot of traveling. Well, I know I'll be doing a lot of traveling to talk about the book. There's people that really want to hear about it. But over the summer, I'm going to try to take some time and think about what's next. And I'm not positive yet, but I think I want to work on what I think is a fascinating development, which is, I don't know exactly how to describe it, but I've been thinking about it as sort of left-wing capitalism, if I can put it that way.
Uh-huh.
This kind of, you know, increasingly what we see is progressive causes being embraced by corporations, for example. You know, I encountered this living in Indiana when the Indiana State Legislature passed a RFRA law, Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And it was all of the big corporations, both in-state and out-of-state, that came down like a hammer and demanded, and indeed ultimately forced then-Governor Pence to back down out of fear of economic destruction, boycotts of the state. And so I think we have this sort of inherited view that sort of capitalism is a conservative thing and conservatives like capitalism in the free market. And I think there's an interesting time to reassess some of these assumptions given I think what we're seeing, you know, in developments in Silicon Valley and, you know, technological things we've been talking about. So I'm thinking that it might be a helpful intervention in contemporary debates that seem to me, again, to be rutted and not necessarily thinking where we are now as opposed to where we were during the Cold War.
Well, very good. Well, we've been speaking with Professor Patrick Dineen, author of Why Liberalism Failed. Congratulations on the success of the book. It is
wonderful.
I don't think I'm exaggerating to say that this is probably one of the most important books of the year that's come out. So,
but Mark, the year just started.
I know.
It's more important
exactly.
than that.
Yeah, no.
It is one of the best books I've read in many years.
It is true. The year is still young, but yeah. But thank you very much for being with us, Professor Dineen, and we'll have to look you up as your next project gets completed.
Thank you. Well, thank you for those words of high praise. I'm humbled, and I very much appreciate them. You write a book, and you just hope you find some readers who are interested in it. So I'm very appreciative.
If it wasn't for you all, I don't know what I would do.
Catholic Radio Indy.
What an absolute blessing you are.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a website, CatholicRadioIndy.org, with access to great Catholic resources, including podcasts of all our local programming, podcasts that have been downloaded from all 50 states and over 40 countries on 6 continents. Yes, we are Catholic Radio Indy, but thanks to your support, we're taking the gospel of Christ to the ends of the earth. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
It's not just a radio station, it's a ministry.
Catholic Radio Indy.
You guys just have no idea how much of a difference it makes.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford, and we just got done speaking with Professor Patrick Deneen of Notre Dame University, God's country, as you put it.
That's what I call it. That's right.
Discussing his book, Why Liberalism Failed. Fantastic, fantastic interview.
Yeah, the insights that he shared during that interview really are a bunch of encapsulated and sort of knowledge nuggets, if you will, about what you're going to find if you pick up the book. And I got to tell you, I think he's really touched a nerve, if you will. There does seem to be this, as he mentions in the book and during the interview, that people just generally, you talk to people, you kind of take the temperature out there in the culture, and there's that kind of anxiety we talked about. There's this kind of unsettledness that something's not right, but it's hard to put, it's hard for any one of us to kind of express what that is or put it into words. It's that kind of like the spidey sense is tingling in the back of our neck, and you just know something's not quite right with things, but you don't know what it is. And this book is a great opportunity to engage with a great, again, great author, great Catholic, on particular what may be going on. It may answer the question that you don't even know you have yet.
Right, because I think people they're trying to figure out what this ideology is that he identifies as liberalism, and it's in the background. It was part of the founding of this country. I mean, honestly, it's kind of part of the founding of the Western tradition after the Enlightenment, I guess. So it's something that we grow up with just sort of taking for granted. And so when it does feel like things are becoming a little oppressive or a little kooky, we don't quite know where to look. We don't know quite what to look at. And so I think he's done a fantastic job of identifying liberalism as an ideology, identifying, kind of what its component parts are, and kind of, showing the way for, exactly where that discontent is really kind of coming from.
Yeah, we're seeing things in the news and in media where we can't really, we scratch our heads and we can't make sense of it. And it seems as if we keep trying to address, wrangling over, arguing over remedies for symptoms without getting at much more deeply at the root causes. And this is why, the Catholic Cave, Mark, or tried to launch the show, was really the genesis, was to get out these underlying principles. And at rock bottom, what we have, a crisis of our self-understanding of human nature, as the professor pointed out and shared with us. And that's right. If you get that wrong, if we profoundly, in ways we profoundly make mistakes about who we are, where we come from, where we're going, then we're vulnerable to all kinds of errors and permutations and distortions. And that's why it's so important to be grounded in the Holy Catholic faith, because it's this long tradition of Catholic theology and philosophy. I'll go back to St. John Paul the Great. His first encyclical, right, is on what? The redemption of man. And he says it's Christ who fully reveals man to himself. And that's my takeaway from this interview. Is I'm going to go back and reread that encyclical, but I got to encourage everyone to pick up this book.
Right, right. And I will say, even beyond that encyclical, John Paul II's addresses on theology of the body take us a long way of reclaiming a proper anthropology, a proper understanding of human nature that will kind of allow us, I think, to move forward from all of the things that Professor Deneen laid out in his book.
Yeah, and we'll check back in with him maybe later on, and that time maybe it'll be, who knows, Notre Dame football season. Hopefully he'll be having a good year. We check back in. We're going to need your work on that, Professor.
All right, and that is about all the time we have for the Catholic Cave. Trying to put the answers out there, but we only seem to be coming up with more questions. But that's what life is all about. For Tim O'Donnell, for Mr. Mark Tuttle, I'm Kent Blanford. Until next time, may God bless.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to Kent at CatholicRadioIndy.org or by calling 317-870-8400. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at CatholicRadioIndy.org.